Can poetry matter? Reflections on poetry and American culture next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for readings and a conversation with poet and critic Dana Gioia.
Now, I don't believe it's because that poetry is dying or poetry is dead, although perhaps it is living in a nursing home right now. It's that the people in the academy, for their economic survival, for their career advancement, have to talk about poetry, have to behave to one another in certain, after a certain institutional etiquette. I would suggest that the rules that the institution demands have very little to do with what the average person needs. We have a literary culture that's...
Poet and critic Dana Gioia. He'll be back in just a moment to read from his poems and talk about poetry and American culture. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Even though poetry has at times enjoyed a position of importance in our culture, Americans have always had an uneasy connection to poets and poetry. But poetry has also had its advocates, usually university professors or cultural journalists. One such missionary today is Dana Gioia, a full-time poet and critic who's unusual because he's not an academic. Gioia turned to poetry and criticism after working for 15 years in business, including a stint as a vice president at Kraft General Foods. In 1991, Dana Gioia published an essay in The Atlantic entitled Can Poetry Matter? He argued that poetry now belongs to a subculture and is no longer part of our mainstream artistic and intellectual life. Instead, he says, poets are like priests in a town full of agnostics. They may still command some residual prestige, but as individual artists, they're nearly invisible. Yet Dana Gioia does more than lament the situation he describes. In both his poetry and critical writing, he argues for the practical importance and the public accessibility of poetry in American society. Dana Gioia has written for The Nation, The New Yorker, and The Atlantic, and is a translator of Italian poetry. He's the author of two volumes of poems and a collection of critical essays on poetry and American culture. I asked Dana Gioia to read from his work. The title of the poem is Cruising with the Beach Boys.
So strange to hear that song again tonight. Traveling on business in a rented car, miles from anywhere I've been before. And now a tune I haven't heard for years. Probably not since it last left the charts. Back in L.A. in 1969. I can't believe I know the words by heart, and can't think of a girl to blame them on. Every love-sick summer has its song, and this one I pretended to despise. But if I were alone when it came on, I turned it up full blast to sing along, a primal scream in croaky baritone, the notes all flat, the lyrics mostly slurred. No wonder I spent so much time alone, making the rounds in Dad's old Thunderbird. Some nights, I drove down to the beach to park and walk along the railings of the pier. The water down below was cold and dark, the waves monotonous against the shore. The darkness and the mist, the midnight sea, the flickering lights reflected from the city. a perfect setting for a boy like me, the Cecil B. DeMille of my self-pity. I thought by now I'd left those nights behind, lost like the girls that I could never get, gone with the years, junked with the old T-bird. But one old song, a stretch of empty road, can open up a door and let them fall, tumbling like boxes from a dusty shelf, tightening my throat for no reason at all, bringing on tears shed only for myself. I'm a working class kid. I mean, on one side of my family is Italian immigrants. The other side of my family is Mexican American, Native American, born in Los Angeles. I had a happy working class childhood, but my parents neglected to give me the private income I so richly deserved. And so I was forced, alas, to work for a living.
But they did read to you.
Oh, my mother was a working class woman of no great education, knows hundreds of poems by heart. My Mexican grandfather, who sort of Mexican is the wrong word, really. He was born in a New Mexico Indian reservation. He's kind of the old-fashioned, politically incorrect term was mestizo. He's sort of a little mixture of Indian, Spanish, Mexican Indian.
Oh, you're talking to an Albuquerque kid.
Oh, good,
here,
good.
So this makes
he
a
was
lot
a
of
cowboy.
Sense.
My, yeah. my grandfather was a vaquero. Mm-hmm. He went to fourth grade. He knew dozens and dozens of poems by heart. Poetry was the possession of the common person in America 70, 80 years ago. Now, I thought, as many a benighted young man has thought before, that I should make a career in academics. I went to Stanford as an undergraduate, and I did graduate work in comparative literature at Harvard. And I loved it, especially loved literary theory, God help me. But I felt that the better I got at it, the more I studied it, the more I immersed myself, I felt that as an imaginative writer, as a critic who hoped in some way to reach a kind of general audience, my writing was getting worse and worse. I decided that I needed to leave the academy.
Oh, was that because of the academy that the writing was failing, so to speak?
Well, I think it was because of my own personal weaknesses. I'm not going to blame it on the academy as much as the, you know, my own interests were so similar to my teachers. That I was easily seduced, and so I had to. So I quit, and I had to make a living, and I was too dumb for medical school. everybody I knew who went to law school stopped reading, but people in business seemed like they were generally agreeable bunch of people.
Well, now you're part of a tradition, a mini tradition, perhaps here. The name who is the physician, William Carlos Williams.
Yes.
That I suppose you could call that somebody who works in the world of business. And then who is the insurance salesman?
Yeah, Wallace Stevens.
Wallace Stevens, who
was,
wrote poetry.
Yeah, was an insurance lawyer. T.S. Eliot was a banker. James Dickey was an advertising executive. Richard Eberhardt. Worked for the Butcher Wax Company, I believe it was called. There's actually a long tradition of American poets who made careers in business. A.R. Ammons was a chemical glass salesman.
That's true, a North Carolina poet, as
yes.
a matter of fact.
Very fine poet. And so I believe fundamentally that one does not have to be an academic professional to be a writer. I think that it impoverishes the diversity of literature when all of your writers do the same thing. Now, I mean, and it really isn't. It isn't bad that we have poets in the university. It's bad that all of our poets are in the university.
You say in the piece that you wrote in The Atlantic that poetry is flourishing today in a way that it hasn't ever before. There are thousands of people who call themselves poets. We have hundreds of creative writing programs. We have lots of poetry being published. And yet we are faced with this paradox that poetry seems to be on the decline. Explain this to me.
Well, it's very simple sociologically. We have never had a moment in the entire history of humankind in which so many people were paid to profess poetry as we do in America today.
Yet they belong to the universities rather than to the public culture.
And yet, we've never had a civilization, it seems, in which poetry mattered less to the average intelligent, reflective, thinking individual. Surely this is a cultural paradox worth exploring. Now, I don't believe it's because that poetry is dying or poetry is dead, although perhaps it is living in a nursing home right now. It's that the people in the academy, for their economic survival, for their career advancement, have to talk about poetry, have to behave to one another in certain, after a certain institutional etiquette. I would suggest that the rules that the institution demands have very little to do with what the average person needs. We have a literary culture that's focused for the needs of its professionals rather than the needs of the readers.
Now, you talk about the average reader. This the phrase that comes to mind, is it Virginia Woolf who invented the term the common reader?
Well, actually, she was quoting Samuel Johnson.
Samuel Johnson. We go all the way back to the 18th century. What has happened to the common reader? Why don't common readers consume poetry the way, I guess, they used to, according to your argument?
Well, poetry was an integral part of American culture, American popular culture, American public culture.
It had a political function, for example, at the time of the Revolution?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but you can find incident after incident. I mean, the best-selling American author in the 19th century in any genre was Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Hmm. His poems were known by everyone in the United States, and probably a majority of Americans knew at least some part of him by heart. You can find incident after incident of people writing individual poems, like Oliver Wendell Holmes writing Old Ironside,
right,
that galvanizes public opinion, that is read on the floor of Congress and leads to the passing of bills. Edwin Markham's The Man with the Hoe becomes a kind of touchstone for the American labor movement. So there was a moment that went all the way well into our century. In 1959, Carl Sandburg addressed a joint session of Congress. Robert Frost's appearance at JFK's inaugural was not the anomaly that it seems today. Mm-hmm. It was rather the final moment of a kind of dying American tradition.
Well, we had Maya Angelou reading a poem when President Clinton was inaugurated.
Yeah.
I take it you think that's a good thing.
Well, I think it's a kind of cultural conservatism that we can all endorse.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I'm trying to do is to create a serious poetry which does not run away from popular art,
uh-huh,
that pulls its experience out of the experience of the average American. I also want to use rhyme and meter again, but in a way that has something more to do with speech than with kind of the literature of the book.
Uh-huh. All right, and again, to go to the themes that you were writing about here, you talk about connecting poetry to popular culture and everyday experience. You have been characterized as a practical critic, that is, to a practical poet as well as critic, and somebody who takes his work to the public in terms that make sense to the reader rather than the critic and the academic. A 50-cent term here that we could use is new formalism. Talk to me briefly.
Well, new formalism is a name, rather reductive name, I think, in some ways, that critics have given to the kind of work that I and some other poets of my generation are writing. What we're trying to do is to revive rhyme and meter, not throw out free verse, but to use free verse as only one of many techniques. And we're also trying to write narrative poetry again, to tell other people's stories, not just talk about our own problems, and really to combine poetry back with the two things that always nourish poetry, which is song and story.
In other words, you're getting away from poetry as a kind of therapy, which is symbolic of a lot of what goes on in our culture. That inward, sometimes morbid look at the life of the poet rather than the relationship of the poet to the public.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that to a certain degree, you could say that the new formalists are not only motivated by what they want to do, mm-hmm, but what they don't want to do. Mm-hmm. And what they don't want to do is to write a kind of self-indulgent, autobiographical, therapeutic, I could almost be talking to my analyst kind of poem.
Well, let me put it to you this way, Dana. If poetry belongs to the world of knowledge, to the world of culture, and knowledge and culture in our society have become increasingly specialized, and we have seen the payoffs, for example, in science, why is it so bad that poetry become more and more specialized?
Well, there's really two reasons. First of all, no matter what the art history, literary history books tell us, art is not progressive, is not cumulative in the way that science is. One generation, in a sense, of science can build on the past, but it's just like in life that we don't really learn genetically from our parents' mistakes. We have to make all of those mistakes ourselves.
And that's what poets do.
Yeah, and what art is about is really is a conversation between the audience and the artist. Mm-hmm. And that conversation, like all conversations where both people are listening, changes both parties. If you have art as a monologue, it's not really art in the sense that a culture needs it. I believe that poetry is our most concise, expressive, and memorable way of using words. And when a culture loses its capacity not only to create but to receive poetry, it's lost part of its potential as humanity. What I would like would be a culture in which the same people that read novels, listen to jazz, go to good movies, love classical music, reflective, intelligent individuals, not necessarily members of any educational elite or any class, but the way that intelligence has a way of appearing almost everywhere, that those people became an audience for poetry, that they read poetry, and that poets took the responsibility not simply to write for other poets, but to write for them.
You believe in a dialectical kind of design here.
Yeah, although my background is Italian, Mexican, and American Indian, I am Germanic in that.
Let's talk again about poetry as a part of what you call a subculture, Dana. I want you to explain to me the perils and rewards of the presence of poetry in the American Academy.
Well, I mean, I had an old-fashioned Catholic education where I had theology beaten into me from an early age. So I believe there's a lot of value in terms of studying philosophy, and literary theory is, in a sense, a kind of amateur branch of philosophy. I don't think the theory is bad, but I do think it is bad when most of our intellectuals no longer can speak and write in a public idiom.
Well, they run from the public, many of them, as a matter of fact.
Well, and it's because they're focusing their energy not on the total culture, but on their profession. I mean, what's happening in the English department is no different from what's happening in accounting firms. It's no different from what's happening in certain scientific communities. And when all of your intellectuals in a society are more concerned with their own professional agenda than a broader social agenda, you lose not only the communication, but you lose the synergy between fields. And I think America is suffering from a kind of curious atrophy intellectually, amid a superabundance of talent and of interesting things. It would be a terrible thing if the university did not make a home for poetry. Our culture would be impoverished with that. And indeed, some of the smartest, most gifted literary people in the United States are involved in the academy. My problem is not really with the academy per se. It's with the culture in which the academy has a monopoly on serious literature.
All right, now isn't that, after a fashion, the result of what we might call the forces of marketing and poetry as an enterprise in this country? It had to seek refuge in the academy, otherwise it wouldn't have survived at all.
Well, whatever the historical necessity does not alter the problems of the present moment. Mm-hmm. And one can make a very cogent study of how that happened, because really how poetry ended up in the academy is the result of two things. One is modernism as it was interpreted in the United States, which happened to coincide almost identically, chronologically, with the rise of the American university system.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say modernism, we're using a shorthand here for poetry that's tough.
Well, poetry that's tough, and also the notion that especially a writer like T.S. Eliot,
right,
fostered, and his academic critics propagated, that, you know, rather like an intellectual version of a Marine recruiting poster, you know, are you macho enough for modern poetry?
Right.
And naturally, any bright undergraduate or graduate student, you know, wanted to be macho enough to read Pound, Eliot, Stevens, and it became a way of proving your chops. Run the danger of trivializing it, but I don't think I'm missing the spirit of this. And what happened is that if you're a teacher, nothing gives you more joy than demonstrating that you're more intelligent than your students.
Right.
And few things in the history of mankind permit this so easily as modernist poetry.
Uh-huh. Do you think that poetry is going to continue to be, what, the object of a kind of academic enclave here? And the follow-up to that is, how do we get it out of the academy and back to the public?
Well, 3 or 4 years ago, and I when I wrote the, first gave the lecture that became the article, Can Poetry Matter?
That was in the Atlantic magazine.
Yes. I was less hopeful than I am now. I mean, right now, American poetry is going through a kind of chaotic reformulation of itself. And there are a half a dozen significant social factors that are changing the landscape of American poetry, none of which, incidentally, are happening in the university. The kind of dissatisfaction that I thought I felt as a perverse, alienated, lonely individual, I realized were shared by hundreds of thousands of other American readers and writers who felt somewhat alienated from academic culture. And I'm talking about things that, from, on the one hand, that we see in popular culture like rap poetry, regional phenomenon like a kind of rural Western cultural movement called cowboy poetry, mm-hmm. to that kind of yuppie phenomenon that I'm of two minds about, poetry slams, right. but also the emergence of independent bookstores as a kind of non-academic venue for poetry, for serious fiction, for nonfiction.
Now, this is a good thing in your view.
Absolutely. See, I believe that the more diversity that we have in our culture, the more argument, the more complex the dialectic, and the more people that are honestly committed to doing what they believe in, mm-hmm. That out of this will emerge a healthier, more vital, more relevant literary life.
Well, can't to be argumentative with you for a moment, Dana, can't you say that what you're indulging here is a form of nostalgia, that you're looking for a kind of good old days for poetry that may or may not have existed, and that what your problem comes down to simply accepting poetry in forms today that don't bear resemblance to the forms that poetry had, 100 years ago. For example, you mentioned rap. There are scholars who make serious arguments that rap is poetry in the same way that, somebody, you know, like Matthew Arnold, to go to the other end of the spectrum, would have written poetry for his audience in Victorian England.
Well, you've asked several questions. Let me answer them in reverse order.
Okay.
Surely the most interesting sociological phenomenon in the last 10 years in American poetry has been rap, which is the emergence of what is fundamentally an oral poetry out of a kind of disenfranchised urban class that we're not used to hearing from in American verse.
And some people don't want to hear from them.
Well, you know, and I can understand why. There's a kind of noise level involved with listening to rap that is you have to adjust to. Now, rap poetry, curiously, is written metrically in a way very similar to Beowulf. It is a four-stress sort of Anglo-Saxon line. It doesn't have the alliterations. So perhaps I'm indulging in a form of nostalgia, mm-hmm. but the rap musicians spontaneously, in a sense, have reaffirmed a kind of eternal shape of the spoken English line in stress meters. Now, I don't think necessarily that what's been created in rap is very good art, but I don't say that that art form does not have the potential to create very good poetry. Now, something very interesting about it is that I just did an anthology in which I included a Run DMC lyric from Peter Piper. I couldn't find it written down anywhere. My brother, who's a rap DJ in Berkeley, transcribed it for me. I sent it to Run DMC's agent, and they were happy to see it because they had never written down their own lyrics. It is truly an oral poetry.
Dana, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. I'd like you to read to me once again from your poetry.
This is a poem about money written in collaboration with American slang. It has as an epigraph Wallace Stevens' journal entry, "Money is a kind of poetry." Money, the long green, cash, stash, rhino, Jack, or just plain dough. Chalk it up, fork it over, shell it out. Watch it burn holes through pockets. To be made of it, to have it to burn. Greenbacks, double eagles, megabucks, and Ginny Mays. It greases the palm, feathers a nest, holds heads above water, makes both ends meet. Money breeds money, gathering interest, compounding daily, always in circulation. Money. You don't know where it's been, but you put it where your mouth is, and it talks.
Dana Joya, I want to thank you so much for coming by the National Humanities Center. Let me mention a couple of your books and tell our listeners about you. You wrote a book called Can Poetry Matter? It's a collection of essays on poetry and American culture. You've got a couple of collections of poetry, Daily Horoscope and The Gods of Winter. And with X.J. Kennedy, the poet, you're about to publish an introduction to poetry. HarperCollins will bring that out. You're a busy guy. Dana, thanks for coming by.
It's been a delight.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was Dana Joya, a poet, critic, and translator. If you'd like to have an audio cassette of this program, send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 688. That's program number 688. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Include $2 if you'd like to have a complete list of Soundings discussions available on audio cassettes. Next week, reflections on growing up Jewish in the American South. My guest will be Eli Evans. He'll be here to talk about his new book, The Lonely Days Were Sundays. Partial support for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.